jump right into the gospel today and start to talk about this sort of interesting last phrase, last little section we had in the gospel. Truly I tell you, of all those born of women, no one has arisen greater than John the Baptist. Yet the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he is. And clearly it's hard to be definitive about what exactly Jesus is talking about, but I think there are some clues. And I think what Jesus says here will actually help us understand some of the tensions in the lesson that we heard from Isaiah. Now, Isaiah is one of those passages that speaks in an almost typical way of the signs of the coming of the kingdom of God. How will we know when God's presence is among us and God's reign has begun? And we heard it last week, you know, the swords beaten into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks and lions lying down with lambs. And here, as we hear the gospel, the blind receive their sight, the deaf hear, the lame walk, the dead are raised, the poor have good news preached to them. And as you might remember, when Jesus began his ministry in Nazareth, he got up and he unrolled the scroll and read from a very similar passage of Isaiah. Today, the Spirit of the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor, to give the blind their sight and the deaf their hearing. So these are the signs. But there are some parts of Isaiah that get left out. They got left out in the story of Jesus beginning his ministry at Nazareth. And what gets left out is part of the Isaiah lesson today. Say to those who are of fearful heart, be strong, do not fear. Here is your God. He will come with vengeance, with terrible recompense. He will come and save you. This is all the way woven through these themes of the Old Testament. There is the sense that when God comes, God is going to eliminate the enemies of Israel. Eliminate either the political enemies or, moving a little further along, we also hear, a highway shall be there, and it shall be called the Holy Way, and the unclean shall not travel on it. And of course, when you hear those words, I hope your mind goes to the stories of Jesus and how frequently he was found among those who are unclean or who were judged to be unclean. So, in two profound ways, Jesus transforms these expectations and these teachings that come through this Old Testament tradition, because God does not come in violence. And there is not this legitimation of our human judgments that divide the world, good, bad, unclean, clean. We don't usually use those phrases anymore, but we have our equivalents. Though, you know, the way we orient ourselves in the world, those who are succeeding and those who are failing, those who are good, those who are bad. And those judgments are not endorsed by Jesus. Because Jesus really says, if you're honest, we're all unclean. And in some funny ways, Jesus even includes himself in that. When someone comes up to him and says, good master, and Jesus stops him and says, why do you call me good? No one is good but God alone. Jesus says, we're all unclean. And which is to say, our lives are all shaped by self-interest, by fear, by comparing each other, ourselves with each other. We do all of those things. And it blinds us, and it makes us deaf, and it diminishes us. But if the unclean can't walk on God's holy highway, then that highway is going to be empty, because unclean is all we are. And yet, does Jesus, sort of give us that mirror on ourselves to humiliate us, to get power over us, to convince us how worthless we are? No. It's Jesus playing out what we hear in the Gospel of John. The truth will set you free. I mean, it's kind of like what you might experience if you're working with a really good therapist and you're actually able finally to tell the stories of your life and to tell the truth without hedging one way or another or dissembling or trying to make yourself look better than you are. Blessed are you if you take no offense at me. Blessed are you if you let me know you. Blessed are you if you let me hold up a mirror to you so that you can see your actual life. Not so that you'll be condemned, but that you'll know where you might actually change and move more deeply in the direction of life. Jesus alters what came before him. There are many passages in the Old Testament that sound great, but in crucial ways, they don't rise to the level of the insight that Jesus puts before us. And, of course, unfortunately, there are a fair number of passages in the New Testament that don't quite rise to the wisdom of Jesus either. I mean, this wisdom that Jesus is trying to put before us is not easy to embody. It's meant to revolutionize the way we see ourselves and each other. And so when Jesus says, "Don't be blessed are you who take no offense at me," he's really, there's a whole biblical tradition of where we should really be offended. And there are a lot of things that are profoundly offensive about the way the world works. And in some ways, I can't quite tell if we are, as a country, confused about the American dream. Is the American dream, has it become the same thing as the biblical nightmare? Where the American dream is for fewer and fewer people to get more and more wealth and power. And huge energy is devoted to making all of us say, "Well, that's normal, that's fine. They earned their $900 million last year. They did. They worked hard." And from a biblical perspective, we are supposed to be scandalized. We're supposed to say, "This cannot be. This is not." And I think that's part of what it means. When the Bible speaks of blindness, it's not physical blindness. It's walking through a world which you accept as normal things that from God's perspective or from a biblical perspective are abominations, like these huge disparities of wealth. So that, some people make more money than you could ever know what to do with in a lifetime or many lifetimes, and so many people in our country work 40 hours a week and can't pay the rent. And we're supposed to be scandalized by that. But we're not, I think. I mean, if we're going to be in a country that has laws, we should have good laws. But I don't think the answer from a Christian perspective is to figure out some new regulatory agency that is going to take money away from the wealthy and redistribute it. I don't think that's really the answer. I think the answer from the Christian perspective is for us to say, Zacchaeus, you rich tax collector, come down. I see a change in your heart, and I want your life to change so that you enter into a deeper fullness and a deeper joy. Zacchaeus, come down. Which is to say, do we still believe that God can actually change hearts so that people will do the right thing because they actually see what the right thing is to do? And they want to do it. Gives us both the power and the desire to change. John the Baptist, I think, was disappointed in Jesus. "Are you the one who is to come?" he says from prison. And I think John was disappointed in Jesus. John wanted somebody to come in, dramatic, say, "I'm the king, and I will set things right, and I'm the only one that can do it." That was sort of the expectation of the emerging king of Israel. And Jesus went in exactly the opposite direction and included people and did not eliminate enemies, but taught his disciples how to see enemies from a new perspective in which they weren't enemies at all, but brothers and sisters from whom they were estranged. It's a different way to live. And I think John wanted, you know, John, least in the, you know, less than the least in the kingdom, because he just didn't know that God was the God of all people. And this human hope that we have for some agent to come in and get rid of our enemies for us is not part of the kingdom of God. And finally, I just want to put before us the question, is John's question also our question in some way? Are you the one, we ask of Jesus, 2,000 years in the past, are you the one who was to come? Or are we still waiting for another? We often live as if we're still waiting for another. We entertain the possibility of putting some of Jesus' teachings into practice, but they seem too hard, and they will disrupt most normal ways of life, and they will insist that you see the world in a way that will put you at odds with many people that you may share a street with. But what are we waiting for? If we're not waiting for something, then how do we approach this Jesus who has been so covered over with 2,000 years of stories and often self-serving theologies, and yet from the stories about him, still this beautiful, clear voice calling us to see ourselves and the world in a different way? Are we still waiting for something new? Or do we have everything we need already? And if we have it, why do we not put it more fruitfully in practice?